With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Alrighty, welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm your host, Sam Sorbo. We're going to talk today about people who think like you do. And they are more common than you might think. They're just quiet. And then if we get to it, we'll talk about, hey, if we let Seattle go, are we even going to miss it? I saw a meme the other day. I want Cracker Barrel to change its name. It offends me. Sorry. All right, we're going to have some fun. Before we get to that stuff, though, I have joining me Ryan James Gudurski. He's the author, one of the authors of They're Not Listening, How the Elites Created the National Populist Revolution. And so without further ado, he's a political consultant. He's a writer whose work has been featured in multiple publications, including The Washington Examiner, The American Conservative Magazine, The Daily Caller, Human Events, Townhall.com, all of that. And so let's welcome him to the program. Ryan James Gudurski, welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, so we were talking just before the show began about the absurdity of it all. You live in New York City.
Yes, born and raised.
And you said you tried to go out to dinner.
Yeah, I tried to go to dinner the other day, and I'm sitting there outside seating. You know, the nearest table is a couple of feet away from us, not terribly far away, but we're outside. There's demonstrators standing on top of one another, so we figure, okay, let's eat. And we ended up being the last table there, and the police came and, like, started issuing fines to the place. And because I think that they opened, like, the day before they were supposed to or something like that to serve food. And I felt like I was like the 1920s trying to drink alcohol. And you know, it's insane at this point how, you know, the dichotomy of what you can do versus what you can't do. We can't have 20,000 people stand on top of each other for a Black Trans Lives Matter rally in Brooklyn, but we can't go to a restaurant and sit across the table from somebody. And, you know, everything was in plastic. It couldn't have been more sanitary to begin with. But this never ending fear of the pandemic, we're down to, like, I think 20 to 30 cases per day inside the city of 8.5 million. I mean, we are, it's the numbers. I mean, we're to, I think, 4,000 tests per day. The numbers are so low that it makes absolutely no sense why we are continuing this, you know, dog and pony show of keeping our city closed.
Right. And we talked about, you know, they closed the tennis courts, and you're literally, you know, across a court from somebody. Why would they close the tennis courts?
Right, exactly. Couldn't be. I mean, you're 25 feet away. You can't even speak to each other. You couldn't get each other's.
You have to shout. Right. You have to shout at each other. And then there's this.
You can kick their balls, but you can't touch them.
Just so we're clear, so everybody understands. You can kick their balls, but you can't touch them. It is absurd. And there are more and more people who are noticing the absurdity of it. I watched over the weekend a woman who works in one of the sort of frontline hospitals, and I can't remember where it was, but she said it was worse there than in the hospital that she worked in Iraq. And she said that they were only taking COVID patients. And so everybody that they took was branded a COVID patient or a COVID rule out, which doesn't. So labeling somebody COVID rule out doesn't actually, it's not medical. You're not actually allowed to do that. Do you know about that?
So my very good friend of mine runs one of the major chains of hospitals in New York City. And so here's what happened in New York, because we were the epicenter.
Yeah.
So New York has two kinds of major hospitals, trauma hospitals and major medical facilities that deal with things like cancer. The places that dealt with things like cancer had actually very few deaths and were very well maintained. The problem was that too many people are going to trauma hospitals, which are for car accidents or for stab wounds or something like that. And that's where you, like Elmhurst Hospital in New York City, which was one of the famous ones. And that's where you saw the huge explosions, because they didn't have the most basic things to manage or deal with this type of illness. And they were so overwhelmed in those situations. So that's really where you saw the explosion in death courts and in cases in New York. And I think that was really the drastic dichotomy. And, you know, I never give this man credit, but I will give him credit now as time has changed. You know, Bill de Blasio was very late to the game. You know, in early March, he was saying, go out and have a good time. But when he realized what was going on, he was telling the governor, shut down the subway system, shut down New York City, shut down the roads, make sure we can't leave the city and get out to Long Island or to upstate and spread this disease around. And really, it was Andrew, and I never give de Blasio credit. He's been the worst mayor of my lifetime. But he was right in that moment, even though he was late to it. It was Andrew Cuomo who was like, no, we have to make things go as long as they possibly can. And he mismanaged the situation so badly. I mean, I know that he can't be brought up on charges for it, but there should be a serious investigation to just how badly this man mismanaged the situation and not only spread it around New York City, but then the entire country came out of New York.
Give me three highlights that are an indictment of Andrew Cuomo.
Well, I mean, the nursing homes, which everybody knows. I mean, it's insane how he was warned, do not put nursing home patients who are sick with coronavirus back into nursing homes. He did it anyway. That caused 6,000 deaths out of 30,000 in the whole state. It was 1 in 5 nursing homes. A lot of minorities, too, because it wasn't private nursing homes. It was the public nursing homes, which are for poor, lower-income seniors. Right. So that was a major, major one. Secondly, wouldn't shut down the subway system, which spread it terribly around, because the subway, even though it's the city, is controlled by the state, not by the city. So wouldn't shut down the subway system, that spread the disease rampantly across the entire 5 boroughs, because a lot of the areas that got it worse were the transplant areas. And then thirdly is that he was very late to the entire thing when it comes to shutting down even airports, which is something that he could have been asked to do, and he refused to do that either. That's really how we got it spread throughout the entire country, is either the major roadways or airports. People were so afraid that they were leaving the city and taking the disease with them throughout the rest of the state and the rest of the country, and he was so refusing to do any of that stuff to prepare,
right,
that it was a disaster.
Right. And so that brings me back to this video that this nurse had gone undercover because she couldn't believe what she was seeing in the hospitals. And one of the things that she talks about is the idea that they will admit a patient and call it COVID rule out, and therefore bill for COVID, which the billing for COVID is substantially elevated against billing for anything else. So and because the hospitals aren't allowed to have other patients, they basically all other surgeries and other procedures have been canceled, right, due to COVID. The hospitals are suffering for money, so now they're further incentivized to incorrectly classify the patient anyway. Okay. So they classify these patients as COVID rule out, which is not a medical terminology. You're not allowed to do that, but they did it anyway. And then they would put them on the floor with the COVID patients, and the nurses would go from room to room.
Right. Well, the problem is also, I mean, because they've done that, because they shut down all elective surgeries and everything else, hospitals are now laying people off.
Right.
Which is, this is the medical industry during the time of coronavirus. They are laying people off in New York City. I know this for a fact because they run the Mount Sinai Hospital System. A very good friend runs it, and it's people are getting the pink slip at this point. I think that it really shows you, and you know what? Even more, and liberals like to blame President Trump, conservatives like to blame all the, you know, Democratic governors, whatever. I think this really just shows you the failings of the institutions inside the government. The CDC has had billions of dollars with it every single solitary year to get ready for pandemics. And it wasn't President Trump who cut it. They had this money anyway. The CDC had billions and billions of dollars ready for a million for plenty of things, to have ventilators, to have, you know, whatever. And they didn't do any of the preparation work. And it really shows you the failure of government to sit there and be planning into the future for any kind of major disaster, which kind of shows you what could happen next. What could be the next thing be? A terrorist attack, or, you know, whatever it could be. Really, it falls on behalf of the individual to really prepare themselves, because the government really cannot, it really can't get itself straight.
Right. And that brings us to your book.
Yes, thank you for mentioning it. So the book,
called They're Not Listening, How the Elites Created the National Populist Revolution. So I want to talk about your book. And my first question is, do you think that all of this mismanagement, by the way, there are plenty of people out there who are sort of signed up with conspiracy theorists and say this is all on purpose. And it's hard, honestly, it becomes hard to argue with them because of the gross negligence and incompetence that has led us to where we are. When you realize that they've incentivized the hospitals to classify patients as COVID patients, they've intermingled COVID with non-COVID. They've intubated, this nurse is telling a whole story about how they intubated a young person who really didn't need to be intubated, did not resuscitate him, even though he didn't have a DNR. It's a horrifying story,
well,
frankly.
I will say this about conspiracy theories. If it was just the United States, I'd sit there and say you have an argument. It was the entire globe, and the entire globe mismanaged it, because in the West especially, we've become very laid back. We've come to assume, and right. This is especially true of my generation, that prosperity is the de facto, when in fact it is not de facto. It is something that is of the recent last 100 years we've had this wild prosperity. And what my book focuses on, They're Not Listening, is in 2016 when Brexit happened, when Trump was elected, kind of everyone sat there and said, oh wow, there's challenges to this neoliberal order since the Cold War. The fact that the governing class and the elite class and media and in education sat there and said borders don't matter, people are interchangeable, trade deal, it doesn't matter what happens to middle America if they die of Oxycontin overdoses and prescription drugs overdoses. And, you know, it doesn't matter if we have bad wars and we can force democracy on Middle Eastern countries. They just so ignore the mood of the country for year after year after year. And what my book does, it chronicles it on a global level. Because too often people in the media will say, oh, it's just a bunch of racists who sit there and say this. Well, no, it's happening in Africa and in South America and in Europe and in Asia and in Australia. It's happening over the entire world.
The nationalist or populist movement.
National populism is happening across the entire... Yes, it's happening in parties like the Democratic Center in Colombia, in Angola. Angola deported more illegal aliens than the United States did, and they did in a 2-year period. In Chile, in India, we have Modi. All of these countries have things, and I just focus on democracy, so I don't talk about Putin, I don't talk about Turkey, I talk about real democracies. And what these movements have in common, what these people have in common, is they believe their borders and their history and their people matter. And too often the elites don't. They could sit there and say, oh, what does it matter? We can exchange a ninth generation dairy farmer in Wisconsin for, you know, an illegal alien from El Salvador. They're all the same thing, as long as the GDP goes up, as long as the stock market goes up. And I think that what people don't realize is that the mood of the country was shifting little by little by little. And we saw this in Central Europe, in Switzerland and in Hungary in the 90s. And there was these little advances. We saw them kind of eke out in country after country after country, and they were ignored. And then 2016 was the catalyst, and they sat there and said, why did this happen and when? And my book explains it on a global level, so you don't feel like you're isolated. It's not just old white men in Ohio. This is around the entire world. It's young people. Everybody, and why this movement cuts across country, nationality, religion, race, and where it's moving to in the future.
Okay, so Hungary springs to mind because they were on the first wave, in a sense. Brexit, Hungary joined fairly.
Starts in 1998. Viktor Orban was elected to lead Hungary in 1998. That's insane. That's in a very long period of time.
What do you mean? Sorry.
It's been 22 years. Oh. Viktor Orban has been in power for he lost power for a little bit between then.
Right.
But almost continuously for 22 years. That is a very long time for any leader.
So do you make the argument in the book for why national populism is the way to go? Or are you against it?
If you are a supporter of national populism, I explain it, and I give, there's like 700 citations in the book, so I explain it thoroughly. This is why you feel. You know, they just did, Cambridge University did a study in Africa, and they did 16 different African tribes having to force to live to one another. And you know what happened? Civil society broke down.
Having trust to what? Sorry, I got jumbled. 16 different tribes doing what?
we're forced to live among each other. We're forced to live among each other, almost like a form of mass migration. And they're all black.
Who did that? Like, how did that happen?
This was an experiment that they did.
Oh, they, okay. So they forced them. Okay.
Yes. Yes. With Cambridge University. And they found out that trust, they're all black. There's no racial issue. They found that social trust declined substantially and institutional trust declined substantially when you're forced to live around people you don't have a say in it. And so for 30 years, 40 years, American Southern said,
hold on,
need to take
hold on. I'm sorry. They forced people to live together, but
yes,
because they did a study. What did they do? Go in and put in dictators or something? Or did they get people to volunteer?
This was on a local level. So it was like, I think a group of like 1,000 people.
But how do you force somebody to do something if you're doing a study? Like, that just sounds...
I think it was incentivized. I don't know the exact metrics of how they did it. I know the outcome of the study.
The problem is if these people volunteered to do this and tested this way, then the test results are skewed actually... How do I put it? More positively than the. In other words, if the results come out negative, which they do, people don't like each other, right? They distrust each other if they aren't similar cultural norms. They distrust each other. These people should be actually on the most positive end of that scale. So you would say that people who wouldn't volunteer for this test, assuming that they volunteered and they weren't just coerced or whatever, right, would be even less amenable.
I bring up this study because this has been a thing that they've actually, sociologists have studied over a period of 20 years. And every single study says the same thing. Mass diversity over the long term is very good as long as people can assimilate to one another. If they cannot assimilate, if they cannot figure a way to sit there and integrate with each other, it is a terrible thing because it breaks down civil society. And social science have sat there and said this over and over and over again. This was the first study to slowly focus on Africa. That's why I thought it was interesting.
I love it. I love it. And then my comment is no duh.
Yeah, of course. But politicians in Washington understand that. They can't seem to sit there and get that. Politicians in Europe couldn't really sit there and seem to get that. And so I talk about
they have other motives and goals.
Of course, because if you look at the last 20 years, there is a huge difference if you are black in the Mississippi Delta or Native American in South Dakota or white in West Virginia and Kentucky than you are if you live in New York City or the suburbs of Denver or Washington, D.C. Your life has been drastically, drastically different. And so the fact that people are angry and they don't know why they're angry, I try to sit there and explain, this is why you feel like you have not gotten a fair shake. And to those who don't like national populism, I explain, this is why it's growing. These are the policies that you are advocating for that is hurting your fellow countrymen. And it's the difference between those who will live anywhere in any Western style liberal city and those who live somewhere, those who choose to live in the place that their parents and grandparents were buried, those who actually have a foundational experience in a certain location and neighbors and community. And that's really the divide across the entire globe.
That's interesting because I'm definitely a national populist and I don't live anywhere where my grandparents lived.
Well, you choose to live somewhere that means something to you. You wouldn't exchange where you live for Qatar or for, you know, Singapore or for Tokyo.
That's just regular people, and actually is not terribly true of me because I have lived abroad, but I now choose the United States because it's so much better.
Right.
Many people are choosing the United States not because they're national populist, but because it's better.
But I think if you look at most people, if you look at the average, I don't know, truck driver from Ohio or the average person from, who's a dairy farmer or whatever, they choose. There's something about investing in a place for generations. Maybe you're the exception. You don't have the physical characteristics, but most people who do live somewhere, especially if they have children early on in their life, tend to stay in the same location for generations.
So what do you make of the fact that this generation, as the preceding ones before it, is probably the best traveled generation in history? Like, we have been more and more travel prone. Do you suppose that has changed our mindset at all?
That's an interesting concept. I never thought of it like that. I don't know if that's true, because while young people in America tend to be more liberal, it's not the same in places like France, Germany, or Italy, which are also very well traveled, but they are also they are more right wing than their grandparents are. So I don't know if that. I think it has more to do really the university education than it does traveling, because. I think that's a good point of saying is that it's better. I think it's more point to say if you've had a university education, how you'll have a opinion of the world versus if you're well traveled.
That would be an interesting study, frankly.
Yeah, no, it would be. That's really, really smart. That's a good question. I never thought of it like that. But I think that that is part of it. There's it's not just advantageous to go travel somewhere, to go on vacation somewhere and learn another language. That's fine. It's the point that places and people are disposable. That is a mindset that certain people have. And I've been to meetings in Washington, D.C., where I'll mention different cities and they'll say, oh, the place is terrible, Iowa or wherever. And they truly have disdain for regular people. I mean, truly. And these are the governing class. And I think that that is really the mindset I'm talking about, not so much of the idea of.
Now. And you're saying that that's the mindset that created the national populist revolution.
Yes,
like, don't count us out because we're still here. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
It's the people like, you know, who advocate who during the 8 years Bush was president, we saw the rise of the opioid epidemic and it was totally ignored. And where did that hurt the most? That hurt in the counties and in the states that voted for him twice. That is really an abhorrent way of governing when the people you're supposed to be looking out for, you're not looking out for. And that was the mindset that came out of Washington all the way until Donald Trump became elected. And then they had a freak out saying, why are we losing power? This is why you're losing power.
So you have delivered one of these books to every congressperson.
A few congresspeople have bought it. They did. Actually, a few of them reached out to me and said they have bought it. I would like more to.
Yeah. Sure. The name of the book is They're Not Listening, How the Elites Created the National Populist Revolution. It's very clever, actually. I like the idea behind it. What are you hoping? Because obviously you're trying to sell books and you want people to read it. And there's a lot of good information in there. But what's the thing that you're really hoping people can take away from reading this book?
One, that they're not alone, that any charges of being called a racist or, you know, a bigot or xenophobe is a complete lie. It's happening all over the world, regardless of race or religion.
Right.
And I want them to know the facts and I want them to know the statistics. I want them to have the supportive arguments. All my statistics come from left-wing outlets tend to or mainstream media outlets. So these are not conspiracy theories. These are not, you know, it's not going to the townhall.com or places.
How can you trust the statistics then?
Because they do once in a while, they let the truth slip out. And I spent a lot of time looking for that truth. And I think that it's really an important argument to sit there and have. And so if you feel like you are being told to shut up and to sit down and to just take whatever Washington is spewing at you, this explains how you are more powerful than you think you are and how you're not alone and how all of it explains and validates all of the criticisms you may have had for the last 10, 20, 30 years about the way and direction our country's been going.
Right. So you've got endorsements from Ann Coulter and Michelle Malkin has
JD
said,
Vance.
Yep. And she said that you've written a critically important guide to nationalism dash populism here in America and around the world. It's great. And it's great to have you on, Ryan. Ryan
Thank
James
so much,
Gerdusky.
Sam.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll talk to you again soon.
Bye.
Well, all right then. That was fascinating. And it's interesting. Like, I thought it was going to go one way, then it went a different way, then it went back one way. It's kind of interesting. All right. So that's my dog. There is no way for me to shut him up because I am live on air, which is fascinating. I want to play this for you. This is Burgess Owens. He's talking to Jan Jakielic, and this was this is him talking about the defund the police movement. Listen.
I think we need to start off with the understanding that we as a country have all come together with the same conclusion that no one's life should be taken the way that was, the way George Floyd's life was taken. It's no doubt about it that it was brutality, it was evil. But what we don't do is we don't return evil with evil. We have rule of law in this country. And what we have to understand is that this movement that we're speaking of today, that has now continued to roll across our country, that's continued to now devolve to conversation with defunding the police or making police as being the worst things ever in the history of our country. This is not about George Floyd.
All right. So I first want to point out, I actually met this individual. He is absolutely lovely. He made me wear his Super Bowl ring. It was pretty cool. But what he says here is, it's important.
And his brother said that as the riots were going on, his brother said, this is not what George would want. What it comes down to is we have people out there. We have an evil ideology. We have here a movement that's been laying in wait, waiting for an opportunity to pounce on American people. I could have told you last year that this would be a year of riots. I could have told you last year, just like 4 years, I could have told you it was a year of riots. And 4 years before that. And during these riots, guess who gets hurt the most?
This is important.
This ideology, people who hide behind things that sound good and go and destroy our own communities. They go and destroy black businesses. They go into the inner city where people are trying to work hard to pull themselves up, to reach that middle class, to serve their community and project their goals and dreams and taking risks. And guess who's destroyed? And nothing's ever said about it. The black lives.
It's the black lives who are destroyed with all of this. That's what gets me. And I'll tell you something. I had a tough week. I don't know about you guys, but I had a very tough weekend. Just trying to sort of process all of this. So up on Gatestone Institute, this is a great resource. Soren Kern writes prolifically over there, and he put together a brief history of Antifa. This is part one, and I'm just going to go over some of the highlights with you. First of all, what's amazing is one of the photos here of an older gentleman, white hair, beard, wearing just a patterned shirt, a plaid kind of a shirt, with a backpack on, and his face is entirely covered with streaks of blood. A common tactic, this is the caption of the photo, common tactic used by Antifa in the United States and Europe is to employ extreme violence and destruction of public and private property to goad the police into a reaction, which then proves Antifa's claim that the government is fascist. This was in Portland, Oregon. This photo was snapped. The senior citizen was fleeing after being brutally beaten by members of their local Antifa. Now, of course, we have the Nation of Chaz in Seattle begging for food. They're such idiots. I'm struggling with all the useful idiots who sign up. The do-gooders who believe that black lives do matter, but pay no attention to any statistics. I got into a bit of I wouldn't call it an argument. It was a discussion with a liberal friend of mine who said, she's not a Trump fan, obviously. She's a big Obama supporter. And she said, and I find it so fascinating because she takes my advice. She seeks my advice on literally everything except politics. She won't take any information from me on politics. And we got into this discussion about COVID. And she said, Trump is just, you know, he's really disappointed me. And I know we don't talk about politics, Sam, but I just have to tell you, he's really disappointed me. I said, really? How? She said, he waited so long to act. I mean, he called it like that it was a hoax and he didn't believe it. And now look, and he waited so long before he did anything. And of course I said, really? So when he closed flights, he shut down the flights from China from entering the United States on January 31st. And 2 weeks later, all the Democrats were still calling him a xenophobe and saying he was overreacting, that this was nothing to be concerned about, and everybody should celebrate the Chinese New Year's down in Chinatown. He was too late. Everyone else was much later, but apparently he being more than 2 weeks early, that was too late for you? And by the way, the entire press was against him. What do you expect from him? Do you expect him to act before anybody else acts fully and completely? Even while his own, the people who work with him in government were saying, don't do it. Oh, but blame, but put the blame at his feet. Put all the blame at his feet. Cuomo said, hey, take the COVID patients, put them in the nursing homes. He ought to be prosecuted. But let's blame Trump for that. All right, so a brief history of Antifa. Empirical and anecdotal evidence shows that Antifa is, in fact, highly networked, well-funded, and has a global presence. It has a flat organizational structure with dozens and possibly hundreds of local groups. That way, the flat organizational structure means that there's nobody at the top to take out. You can't sort of cut off the head and then hope that the body fails. It's like an amoeba. In fact, we should call it amoeba instead of Antifa, because Antifa is an incorrect name. They are not anti-fascist. They are extreme versions of fascists. Their stated long-term objective, both here in America and abroad, is to establish a communist world order. Well, fascism is really just another form of communism. I know. You learned in school that fascists are right-wing. That's why they call themselves Antifa, to make you think that they're anti-right-wing, which they are. But fascism is not anywhere near the right side of the spectrum. It is very left, because it is also totalitarian in nature. In the United States, Antifa's immediate aim is to bring about the demise of the Trump administration. Well, duh. A common tactic used by Antifa in the U.S. and Europe is to employ... Oh, I did read that. So we have the George Floyd death, which everybody agrees should never have happened. Everybody. I have not heard one person arguing on behalf of kneeling on the neck of somebody until they expire, or really kneeling on the neck of somebody at all, ever. Although we still don't know all of the events surrounding that. And frankly, the cops who are standing around like laughing and joking about it, same. But there's also the story of the young white guy who was asphyxiated by a cop. And there were a couple of black cops in that, and they were joking about, hey, time to wake up, time to go to school. They were joking after he had already passed, because they didn't realize that he was dead. But that wasn't racist. Only George Floyd is an example of racism. Antifa is not only officially tolerated, but is being paid by the German government to fight the far right. That is according to Bettina Roll. She's a German journalist in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. Out of cowardice, its members cover their faces and keep their names secret. Antifa constantly threatens violence and attacks against politicians and police officers. It promotes senseless damage to property amounting to vast sums. That's also a quote of from Bettina Roll. So now you know a little bit more about Antifa. It's been described as a transnational insurgency movement that endeavors to subvert liberal democracy with the aim of replacing global capitalism with communism. And it's aided and abetted by the lack of education that so many people around the world have. Their nemesis include law enforcement, which is viewed as enforcing the established order. They claim to oppose fascism, which is a term that's often used as a broad brush pejorative to discredit those who hold opposing political beliefs. The traditional meaning of fascism is, quote, this is according to Webster's, a totalitarian governmental system led by a dictator and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism, militarism, and often racism. But the problem is, fascism is, first and foremost, a totalitarian governmental system. That's communism. The only difference is that in fascism, let's see, in communism, the government owns everything. In fascism, there are still private citizens that can own things. It's just that the government tells you exactly what you're allowed to do with those things. And basically controls everything, and so you really have no autonomy. Antifa holds the Marxist-Leninist definition of fascism, which equates it with capitalism. But of course, the Marxist-Leninist definition of capitalism is incorrect. Antifa's fight against right-wing extremist is a smokescreen. This is according to Germany's Domestic Intelligence Agency. They issued a special report on left-wing extremism. They said, Antifa's fight against right-wing extremists is a smokescreen. The real goal remains the bourgeois democratic state, which, in the reading of left-wing extremists, accepts and promotes fascism as a possible form of rule and therefore does not fight it sufficiently. Ultimately, it's argued fascism is rooted in the social and political structures of capitalism. Accordingly, left-wing extremists in their anti-fascist activities focus above all on the elimination of the capitalist system. So they're all misunderstanding. But you know what? At least they are clear that they want to fight capitalism, which has produced the greatest leap in prosperity for humankind the world over, known in history. That's got to be a winning fight. How do you argue with that? It's just so stupid. All right. I wanted to share this with you all. This is out of a newspaper, I guess. Somebody sent this to me. They're holding every evening, they're holding at 8 p.m. Central, 1 minute of prayer for the safety of the United States, our troops, our citizens, and for a return to a godly nation. And so they are they're trying to encourage people, if you have a smartphone, set an alarm to pray from 8 to 8:01 p.m. Central. And also you can share that with your family and friends, obviously, the more the merrier. I was out for a walk and I met a new neighbor. I'm new here, so every neighbor I meet basically is a new neighbor. And we were chatting and she did not have a mask on, which already like boded well. And her dog also was not wearing a mask. So can you imagine? That's what I ought to do. I ought to put a mask on my dog when I walk him just to see what people say. Anyway, we started talking and she finally said, well, I think this is all a hoax. And I'm like, yeah, you're not the only one. There are a lot of people out there who are of the opinion that this is, at this point, a hoax. And Kurt Schlichter put up a very clever article on townhall.com. He says, we keep hearing about how various institutions should, quote, be like America, which apparently does not include you. This is especially true of the garbage media, where the traditional conservative common sense voices of people who don't look like they staggered out of a Goucher College gender studies seminar struggle session with blue hair and a bowl through their lip babbling about privilege, patriarchy, and pinkoism. You don't count, at least not to them. In fact, people like you and what you monsters think must be made invisible. He talks about the Tom Cotton article. Tom Cotton wrote an op-ed for the New York Times that the New York Times published. 58% of folks agreed with his position that if local governments could not or would not, which is plausible, he argues, would not prevent mass leftist violence, the president ought to consider the use of active duty military forces under the Insurrection Act. 6 out of 10 Americans agreed with that, but the New York Times retracted it, issued an apology, and the Lil Maoists delighted in their total victory. The alleged newspaper of record will not cannot dare mention what an enormous percentage of Americans believe, and the trash leftist glorified cable access channels are the same. So if you happen to be passing through an airport lounge recently, did you see one single voice on MSNBC, CNN, expressing the view that the rioters are criminal scumbags and that we ought to stop them even if it takes the 82nd Airborne? No, but the vast majority of people think that. I guess that's what I'm struggling with now. Well, partly. They've created their own echo chamber. Social media. You know, it's funny because my pastor doesn't call it television anymore. He calls it tell-you-vision because they're telling you what to think all the time. They're not presenting both sides. By and large, they're not presenting both sides. They're telling you what to think. And you are to think that the protesters are peaceful. Yeah, there are a few bad eggs in the bunch. And that they're righteous. Even though everybody agrees with them. I'm sorry, I have to ask, exactly what are they protesting anymore? Like, what change are they hoping to have? Or maybe that's not it. Maybe it's just, I got to get out of the house, so I'll call it a protest on behalf of George Floyd. And why was George Floyd allowed to have a funeral, and so many people showed up to his funeral, but other people are not allowed to have funerals? In fact, de Blasio was asked, I guess by a reporter, by a Jewish, I'm thinking it was a Jewish reporter, why can you go to a funeral, but in the Jewish community, where it's a religious thing, that we have a certain number of people there to say the prayers over the dead, we're not allowed to do that. But you're allowed to go do stuff. And his argument was that expressing an opinion about, well, really, they're expressing an opinion about perceived racial disparity, right? Perceived racism. That is so much more important than your religion, which is kind of funny because that is its own religion. Those people are religious zealots, but rest assured, they're religious zealots. They worship at the altar of racism. And it's the altar of, let's see, systemic racism and buzzwords. The left is seeking to define the scope of acceptable thought, he writes, Kurt Schlichter again, and they do it by marginalizing the mainstream and mainstreaming the marginal. They do it with sex. They've done it for years with sex. I was watching a movie that is considered, it was an Oscar-nominated, very popular movie called Benjamin Button. I have not finished watching it. I had to turn it off because I get anxious with, there was some gunfight and stuff, and I get anxious. Anyway, I had to turn it off. It's a very long movie. It was, I needed to go to bed anyway. But the movie is about a love story between a man who is getting younger every day and a young woman who is aging every day. And he meets her when he is 65-ish and she's 8. And they're trying to sell us on the idea that this is a wonderful love story. I'm sorry. I was horrified. I know it won Oscars and everything. And, oh, Brad Pitt. And, oh, the makeup was fabulous. And, oh, you know, special effects or whatever. I'm sorry. I can't sign up for a 65-year-old falling in love with an 8-year-old. And somehow that's okay. Well, Sam, he's actually only 12 at that point. He's a 12-year-old in a 65-year-old's body. Did you hear what I just said? Well, as long as you will just self-identify as a 12-year-old, it's okay for you to be an octogenarian pedophile. I'm sorry. No. I'm just, it's just little old me, but I'm saying no, not that, no. And I probably won't finish watching that movie because I'm just, now that I've actually said it out loud, I'm more horrified than I was watching the movie and going, really, they're trying to sell me on this? Did you all see the, what was that movie? It won the Oscar, what, last year or the year before, the Taste of Water or something like that. And it was about bestiality because the woman actually goes and has sex with the water monster or something. Well, that was just the natural progression from Benjamin Button. What do you think? That's why, that's partly why I make movies. It's because I want to give people uplifting, inspirational content, not constant content that literally seeks to make people more depraved than they already are. It's like, if you can't imagine it, we've got a movie to show you what it would be like to be a 65-year-old in love with an 8-year-old. I'm sorry. I found that absolutely disgusting. And also, yes, because I'm fully informed on what's going on in our schools. And if you want to have that conversation, we can. Because they are grooming our children in our schools. I had a lengthy conversation yesterday with a friend I've known for several years. And I've talked to her tangentially, about home education. Oh, Sam. Yeah. Whatever. Blah, blah, blah. Well, now she's considering it. I'm going to share this with you. I actually put out a couple of videos, I haven't put them out yet. I'm doing a couple of videos about this for my YouTube channel. Please go to my YouTube channel and subscribe. I need to work on my subscription rate because it's abysmal. And I need your help. So go to my YouTube channel and subscribe, and also go to samsorbo.com, and you can sign up for my newsletters, which come very infrequently because I'm really not very good at keeping up on everything. But what I do keep up on. So she came over, she actually came over to the house, and we were sitting there, and I said to her, okay, you tell me, because you're obviously seeking, you want to know, you're thinking this might be a good option for you. What's holding you back? Let's start there. And we had talked, we had already talked for a little bit, but when she started talking about what's holding her back, she literally started crying. She said, the school, it was not successful. There were all of these, she had some issues with the school already. And then with the COVID thing, she's like, wow, okay. I really need to consider homeschooling. But she said to me, I'm afraid that I will fail him. She's got the one boy. I'm afraid that I will fail him because I just don't think that I'm adequate. And of course, I started crying too because I can't help myself. I'm just a sap. And I said, you feel inadequate because that's what you've been taught to feel. We've all been groomed. You went to public school, you've been groomed. You haven't been groomed for the sex trafficking necessarily, but you've been groomed to feel a certain way, to think a certain way. You've been brainwashed. Very hard to come out of that. All right, so Kurt Schlichter, he says, look at the defund the police idiocy, this sinister power grab. It's not crazy, but rather a calculated effort to centralize force within left-wing power structures and leave you disarmed and defenseless. Mind you, they have no problem with Antifa carrying their guns, but disarm the police and disarm the populace. You know, gun sales have skyrocketed. Thank goodness. And I hope that they keep going up. Leaving you disarmed and defenseless. It gets the support of only a rounding area of American citizens. It is not a fully supported thing, but it's the only thing you hear on the commie cable shows. Some try to gaslight it so not to freak out the whiny white wine women of suburbia, he says, who know their Ken doll feminized and gunless husbands won't be able to protect them. The sugarcoaters assert that only a stupid conservative dummy would think defund the police actually means defund the police, just like believe all women could never be reasonably interpreted as meaning that people should believe all women, just the ones we pick. I added that last bit. On CNN, one Democrat politician asserted that the fear of being robbed, raped, and or killed was evidence of shameful privilege. I played that for you. By you selfish monsters who prefer not to be robbed, raped, and or killed. Get that? Now you have to be aware of and ashamed of your life privilege. Oh, I was going to play you the celebrity I take responsibility video. You know what? Maybe we'll get to that tomorrow. They put, and there's backlash, thankfully, they put together this video, I take responsibility for racism. And it's a whole organization. It's a website, itakeresponsibility.org. And so all of these celebrities say, basically, they're saying, I take responsibility for racism. And, because I've heard a racist joke and I laughed, or I did, saw some racism and I didn't say anything. And I'm just looking at that and I'm going, wow, these people are all racists. That was my takeaway. Hollywood is absolutely chock full of racists. At least that was my takeaway from that. So Kurt Schlichter talks about when he got into a fight on air with the slimy Don Lennon, who freaked out when he colorfully and uncompromisingly observed that Felonia Milhouse von Pantsuit, which is how he refers to Hillary Clinton, is a creepy sexual abuser enabler. He cut his mic. Lemon cut his mic. He was terrified that someone was articulating memorably the truth. Tens of millions of Americans love and respect the flag. Tens of millions of Americans despise the rioters, support the police, and support President Trump. You're not alone. No matter how much they lie, no matter how much they omit, and otherwise try to convince you that you are. Thank you, Kurt Schlichter. Love that guy. All right, and thank you for joining me so that I'm not alone. You are appreciated. Now go enjoy the rest of your day.